Hi there, a quick note before the episode begins. Did you know that Mija has her own audiobook with exclusive and brand new material? It's called Mija Podcast, the audiobook, an exclusive and never-before-heard collection of memoirs and reflections by her creator, Lori Martinez, about what it meant to turn her own migration story into a fiction series. When you get Ochenta's audiobooks, you're directly supporting our independent audio series productions. You can find it on Libro.fm, Apple Books, Google Play, Storytel, BookBeat, and on your favorite audiobooks app. Also available in Spanish and French.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Bienvenidos and welcome to Mija on the Mic, where me, Mija, interviews daughters of immigrants who are making moves in their industries around the world. Today, I'm so excited to invite author and journalist Carmen Rita Wong. You are an American radio, television, and online journalist, personal finance expert, and author of the brand new book, Why Didn't You Tell Me?, which is a huge page-turner. I'm so excited to talk about it. It explores her journey to finding out more about her cultural origins after the passing of her mother. So thank you, Carmen, for joining me on the podcast today. Let's begin with what is Why Didn't You Tell Me? We have to get to the juicy stuff first because it's.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. What a wonderful, wonderful podcast Mija's on the Mic, because it's just, yeah. If there was one book that was about being a Mija, it would be this one. This is it. My mother kept a lot of secrets. One of them is, of course, my origins. Where did I come from? In the terms of, you know, who my father is and the whole story behind who she was back then when she made a decision to essentially raise me Dominican Chinese, Dominicana in China. And she was Dominican and Papi Wong was Chinese immigrant, both immigrants, arranged marriage. And I was raised a Wong. I was raised China Latina. And for 31 years, and when she got sick with cancer fairly young in her 50s, I discovered that he was not my biological father. And when I confronted her about it, she made up another story. And that was the story I lived with for another 10 years until that crazy thing called DNA testing came about. And I found out it was somebody else completely. So it's as much a book about, you know, it's not a book about me finding a father. It's a book about, I have plenty of those. It's a book about discovering my mother as her, but not as her daughter and not. I had to see her as a full human being. I had to kind of do this psychological detective work to figure out why would she do something like that? Why would she do something that was incredibly painful, because my origins weren't just as easy as father and mother. It was also about race, about identity, then another, a stepfather, and about his race and his identity. And it was so messy and painful, and I needed to understand it. And in discovering who she was as a person, I also discovered myself. So that's the kind of book it is.
It sounds like such an amazing story. And when I first read the description of it, I was like, no, this can't be real. It doesn't sound like it could happen. Like it's a telenovela plot, but it is. It is your reality. I would like to just start off with, you know, you're a finance reporter. It's not something that you're, you know, specializing in. You're not necessarily doing stories about race and culture like this. So I would love to kind of talk about how you shifted into this thinking, into this kind of discourse that you now had to kind of create with their personal story. So, you know, how was that shift for you? And what did it feel like to own your story like this?
Yeah, well, there's two things that have always been there. One is who I am and my identity, of course. And my voice, I've always had one, in the sense I've always been a pain in the ass for people. But I've always been questioning things. And two, I've always been a writer. I started out covering finance at Money Magazine and Fortune. So, you know, in the late 90s, if you can believe it. So I had a career of about 20 years in media covering finance. That included, you know, hosting my own TV show. And I also wrote advice columns. So the writing was always there. You know, moving out of that career, I did well. It was great. But moving on into writing and writing something so personal, and part of the reason why, you know, I had a couple of advice books. I had a couple very lovely, salacious novels that I did as an experiment just to see if I could just do it and have fun, basically writing a couple telenovelas, which was great. I was like, okay, I'm going to do something so big and so personal that, you know, this is going to be, you know, if you're going to enter the room, you might as well enter, you know, full out. So that's what I did. And I've always wanted to write this story. And I'll tell you why. I mean, the impetus was I was that little kid who had a very difficult home life. So I just found solace in libraries, in other people's stories, whether they were real or fake or not, just stories. And I looked in those shelves and I was like, we are not there. Women aren't there. Latina, Asian, Black, we're not there. LGBTQ, I just didn't see us. And I said, well, wait a second. Like, you know, we're American stories. Why don't we hear about our stories? So it became this thing that was always in the back of my head. I wanted to see more of our stories. And the belief that my story, as complicated as it seems and dramatic and all that, Guadalupe was a piece of work, is a very typical American story. I have heard from so many people that their parents kept secrets, they're another race, they have another father, they have another this, they have another. Millions of people share my story, and millions more if you just broaden it out to being, you know, an immigrant, the first born in this country. Huge, right? So I just wanted to add to that, and just another layer of, you know what? I'm sure other people share similarities with me. And I was right. Thank goodness.
Oh my gosh, definitely. I remember reading the synopsis, and I was like, yeah, but this isn't so foreign. I feel like I've heard a lot of stories recently about the DNA testing being a big part of these kind of conversations around our origins. And it's so wild to think that, you know, a couple of years back, we couldn't have even imagined, fathomed that. Speaking of the past, I would love for you to kind of tell us about the young Carmen Rita Wong growing up. What was your childhood like with those blending of cultures?
Well, it was very rich, not financially, but culturally, very rich. So we were in Harlem with a ton of Dominican family that had come, you know, after the wars. So uptown was Dominicana land, and my cousins were there, and tias, and just so many people. But it was between that and Chinatown with Papi Wong. So my worlds were rich beyond belief, right? Was there a ton of love? I don't know, but my abuela loved me. I'll tell you that. But my mother was young and you know, and having fun with her friends and working. You know, they worked for Oscar de la Renta, you know, sewing seamstresses. A lot of Dominican women he employed in his atelier. But then my mother divorced Papi and remarried an Anglo-American man. So he was the complete opposite of Papi Wong. Papi was, to say it any differently, I couldn't. It's just he was a Chinese gangster. He was a gangster. That's one father. And then my stepfather was, she met him, you know, he was a fellow student of a friend of hers at Columbia University in graduate school, economics. So complete opposite. And then he moved us to New Hampshire, which in the late 70s, early 80s was white. I mean, very. Even southern New Hampshire, which is where we were, which is now pretty diverse, right? Back then, I mean, it was farmland. So we left our family, our culture, our food, our music, how we dressed. We left literally everything to live in a white America that was as foreign to me as living in a completely different country. It was isolating. It was very, very difficult. Those were difficult years. So I found solace in reading. And my older brother, who, you know, protected me as much as possible. We fought just like siblings, but my brother was, you know, my big brother, saved my sanity.
That's so interesting because, you know, today we talk a lot about identifying as hyphenated Americans, how do you even define yourself? Or how did you define yourself then? And then through the many stages of your discovery, how did you keep redefining yourself? Because it feels like you're, you know, if you were to fill out this SAT application, fill out this ethnicity form, you know, you have to check everything now, right?
Well, according to my DNA, even with Indigenous too, like I check everything, like literally I've got everything in me. However, that's what this country is. It's all of us. So of course I'm American. But as we know, and as we see much more now, this country is very different simply depending on what state you live in, what town you live in, what city you live in. There are so many different Americas within America. And for me, in terms of biology, what's interesting is, you know, I was very worried about, you know, when I found out that I'm not biologically Chinese, it was devastating because it was, I was like losing a whole identity. But at the same time, I realized, well, what have I really lost? You can't change the fact that I grew up Chinese with a Chinese father who only passed away this June. So he's been in my life 50 years. You can't stop that. That doesn't change me. And what's wonderful is that, you know, the Latino community accepts me, the Chinese community accepts me, the African-American community accepts me because I'm Afro-Latina for sure, for sure. That's very important to me. My daughter, her father's German descent, so she's white presenting. She knows she's Latina, but she also knows she's white. She appears white, right? But she also knows she has, all her cousins are Black, but their last names are Wong. So my family really defies the ideas of what the label of race is versus culture. What I hope is that people take away from my book too, and besides everything about the mother-daughter thing, which is huge, is that race is not culture. And we know that in the Latino community, but a lot of people don't. And these ideas of what it is and stuff, you know, those are put on us. We have to know ourselves, know our families, know where we were raised. I think it's important to not let people tell you who you are.
Yeah, you're a citizen of the world in that sense. I always have the same kind of conversation because I'm Colombian American living in France and my husband's French. And so I have this whole thing of, what are you now? And so I just say, I'm a New Yorker. I'm from Queens.
Yeah. I mean, if people, thankfully, I don't get that question anymore because I was probably just too grown. But like, nobody's just like, oh, what are you? I mean, and also it depends on who's asking me, because I believe that that's like a really loaded question that's full of projections. People love to just project stuff on you. I've had people really, you know, covering finance for so many years, they get these, you know, finance bros think they know everything, you know, and it's like, you know, what are you? And I'm like, I'm Afro-Latina Chinese New Yorker, you know? And they're like, well, you don't look like this to me. You look like that. You don't get to tell the world what it is, right? So yeah. If you're asking me because you're genuinely curious, fabulous. If you're asking me because you want to pin me down so that you can be, you can tell me what my identity is, absolutely not.
And that's so hard, right? Because these days, I think, I mean, coming up in a multicultural community like that, you don't ask yourself these questions because it's only when you exit that space that you get confronted with the fact that not everywhere is this diverse. Not everywhere is, you know, having this kind of mix of communities and races and cultures. Not everywhere will have, you know, the Chinese Cuban restaurant. It's not Washington Heights, like everywhere. But, you know, that's, I completely understand how difficult that shift must have been for you. And so I do want to get into your many dads that you have. But before that, I want to talk about your mother, because, you know, this show is a lot about our relationship with our families and how they shape who we are and how they pass on their cultures to us. So how was that relationship with your mom? You know, how was Spanish in your household? What was the thing that kind of dominated your everyday? What culture?
Mi español es terrible, mira, because I have not been able to practice as much, you know, once my family's passed and I haven't been able to travel during the pandemic. So I'm rusty, but Spanish was my first language. Well, when we moved to New Hampshire, they didn't teach Spanish in school and my new Anglo father did not allow my mother to speak Spanish in the house. It was that whole idea of melting pot assimilation. So I lost my Spanish. The nuns in school only taught French. So I took 8 years of French. Je parle français peu. So I can understand French. It really helped with the Spanish, by the way, because I didn't took Spanish in school, but they have similar structure. So it's very interesting how language can kind of go over time. And then I can travel in Italy and somehow understand because I have all these other languages. But the thing about was more so about just the culture of being Dominican. You know, it was very much the culture of being Latina. I was raised with beauty pageants. My mother put me in beauty pageants. We watched beauty pageants, unfortunately, because boy, does that give you body dysmorphia. But, you know, it was... she wasn't allowed to cook the food anymore, but thank God we drove back to New York often because she was very homesick. And thank God that I had that childhood there with the family, because I think it's one of the most precious things of my life. It fills my heart, even if, you know, my heart wasn't filled necessarily by love. Like I said, abuela was it, but just being surrounded by women of all different colors, families that were made of hodgepodges of, you know, cousins or siblings that weren't related, but maybe were related. Like, we didn't know. I mean, that was very Dominican thing. Like, you took in people, you didn't know. We were my grandfather's second family, you know, like he had a wife and kids he put in the Bronx, but he lived with abuela, who was his second partner. But it was also the food. It was also the music. It was a way of living that was just very vibrant and rich and expressive. And that I never lost.
I'm curious about how that community shaped so much of the connections that you could make when your mother passed. You know, how was that experience of making all of these discoveries within that community? Because I imagine you weren't alone, thanks to that, the rest of your family kind of supporting that
alone.
Question. Really?
Oh, yeah, no. My mother was ostracized by the family. When she moved to New Hampshire, she became pretty cut off. I mean, she talked to cousins and all that stuff, but we became very cut off. And then they decided, you know, my cousins decided that we started talking too white, dressing too white. You know, this, that, the other thing, that she thought she was, my mother thought she was better than everybody else, blah, 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 blah. You know, all of this business. She was raising us very, because then I had four younger sisters after, to be very accomplished. So it was all about college. Her family felt that that was aggressively American, aggressively white. And it wasn't right that she was raising me to go to college instead of getting married and having children. And to this day, a lot of the family still feels that way. And it's fine. Like, but that's part of the culture that, frankly, I'm glad she didn't. And not because I looked down on it, because she gave us choices in many ways. Even though I didn't feel like I had a choice, trust me, she would have killed me, skinned me alive if I did not go to college. But she also did say, you're 18, you go to college and you're out. After that, you do whatever you want. At least I was given another option. And that's very important. So I was always very grateful for that. But no, I mean, and also too, you got to understand about, I mean, to my point about like, there's different communities in different states, in different towns, in different cities, the Dominican, you know, mass immigration that happened during Trujillo and after Trujillo, there was a whole generation that came and they had their kids and then the kids grew up and then the kids moved. So everybody was out of New York City by the mid 80s. My grandparents passed away by early 90s. That's it. Everybody dispersed. New Jersey, Texas, New Hampshire, wherever. We didn't have that anymore. And that's unfortunate. And that's also kind of like an American byproduct, right? It's like you can't keep communities together sometimes.
And it's almost like it's because of the desperately seeking the American dream, you kind of become this individualistic. It always comes back to the same topic on every one of these episodes. Every conversation I've had with other daughters of immigrants, it always comes back to individualistic Western culture versus our communitarian culture and how we have to kind of reconcile the two. And if we can't, then there's going to be a suffering there. And there's going to be what we call generational trauma. So I would like to hear your thoughts on that. You know, you talk about generational trauma, of course, in your book, especially because, you know, all of these things are happening with generations and generations of your family. And now you as a mother are going to be coming with all of this baggage, cultural baggage, emotional baggage, crazy situation baggage. How do you deal with that? You know, how are you kind of facing all of this with your own daughter?
15 years of weekly therapy.
Oh my goodness.
And a master's in psychology. I definitely think that there is pain and heartbreak in both situations. I wish there was a place where I could have felt welcome even though I was different in my own community. You know, even in graduate school, I worked with a Dominican organization that, because of the way I spoke, when I went to leave, I said something about being Dominican and they were shocked. And I said, what did you think I was? And they were like, oh, we just thought you were Anglo. People have ideas of what and how things and culture should be. I desperately missed and mourned my Dominican family and a lot of them because they just did not agree with the choices that we made. Now, I also feel I didn't have a lot of choices, right? I had to do what my mother told me to do, really. But I also, like I said, I'm really happy, especially that I had the choice to be able to pursue a career and be a mother and, you know, all that stuff. I want everyone to have all these choices and not be looked down on in their community if they choose to do that. I think the only idea of individualism that I like is the idea that we treat people as individual human beings, but we live in a community. And that's what I miss. I loved being a community. At one point when my daughter was very young, we lived in a building that had a lot of old school New Yorkers in it. And I loved it. It was a very mixed building, but all of the neighbors knew each other. We all knew each other. And it was just like when I was a kid, when you could just like go down the hall to play, just go, you know, or just go down, you smell something good and you're like, you know, knock, knock, what are you cooking? You know, that. It's great. And that's part of the community that I absolutely miss. I think, you know, with the therapy, what I've realized is we have to make peace with what we've been given. We can pursue and mindfully try to live the values that we want. But we also have to live in a society and with families that maybe don't accept those values. So, for example, I have redefined what family is to me. Family are people who show up for me and my daughter. I show up for you, you show up for me. If you do not, even if we're biologically related, sure, you're relatives. Do you know what I mean? And that doesn't necessarily jive with Latin culture so much. It's like, if you're related, you're related, period. And you owe people stuff and they're like, you owe them this and that. And I say, you know what? For my mental sanity's sake and for the value of myself as a human being, as an eldest daughter, I'm sure you've had a lot of eldest daughters, right? On the show.
I am the eldest daughter.
There you go.
Myself.
There you
go. So I have that.
Girl, we will get skinned alive if we don't set boundaries as to how that idea of family love works. Because that's what happened. Man, I would kill myself for everyone's love. Kill myself. I'd run myself to the ground. Always the one, you know, paying for this or giving this or taking care of that or calling or showing up or arranging or bill. Always. I'm always there for you if you need me. But when tables turn, who's there for me, right? So I just think that we can honor family, but we can also define family. And it's so much better for our mental health when we've been the only ones doing the eldest daughter syndrome.
Yeah. And when you have all of those responsibilities on your shoulders and you know, decide that to choose wellness and to choose your own happiness, it can be hard to accept.
You said your own. And then I'm like, well, there's the individualist part, right? Choosing my own happiness. But here's what I say. The part of the reason why I'm in therapy for so long and choosing to be more well, it's not for me. It's for my daughter. I want to be a better mother to her. I want to be a better citizen of this world. I want to be a better person in this world. I believe that that's part of the community element that may be being forgotten. Because it's not about boundaries for me. It's boundaries so I can breathe, live, survive, and serve better and love better.
Thank you for sharing that as well, because I think it's a challenge. Like, everyone has their own perspective on it, but in the end, we're all just trying to be better humans. So as much as damaged as we are, as much baggage as we have, we're always trying to be better people to ourselves and to other people. I love seeing it that way. these interviews end up becoming therapy for me because it's we're all kind of facing these same things. So I do want to get to your many fathers. I mean, as a daughter in those different spaces, like you said, you know, you had New York and you're the daughter, everyone's daughter. You're Miha for everyone in the sense that, you know, the community is kind of taking care of you. They're caring for you. But like going to your actual fathers who made you, what is that relationship like?
I'll tell you this. I've had three fathers, but not one whole one. So I wrote this book as a conversation with my mother's ghost because my mother was the most important figure in my life and shaped my life tremendously. There was Papi Wong, right, who was the father. He was raised as him as my father, but I didn't live with him as I grew up. We moved to New Hampshire, and then I lived with my stepfather, who I call Marty in the book. And then he has four girls with my mother who I helped raise. You know how it goes. But my brother and I are the Wongs. And then, of course, I find out about a biological father. Here's what I'll say. I like to not focus on them very much. They're part of things, you know. They were partially always there in a way, but none of them were my father. Papi Wong is like, sure, he was always around at some point, except when he was put away, if you know what I mean. You got to read the book because it's saucy. And he was a colorful, colorful character and always showed up and come on, how much money you want today, you know, and he made up for his lack of being around with, you know, $100 bills and that sort of thing. But he was a wild, chaotic character who I realized, though, now that he passed away in June, and I realized that he was actually the most my father, even though I never lived with him, because he actively wanted to be my father. He called all the time like a pain in the ass, but he always, always wanted to be in my life. Marty's still around, so I don't like to talk about it too much out of respect for him and my sisters. But I'll say this, it's a very different form of parenting. I think that Papi, as the years go by, like, I just feel like he was very much my father in the end. He absolutely was, even though I lived under the roof with Marty. I very much wanted him to be my father because I wanted this whole, I mean, who wants, okay, so on the one hand, I got a gangsta who's crazy. And then the other hand, I've got this, you know, very professional, suit wearing, briefcase wearing, builds my mother a house, you know, American man with the Wall Street Journal and blah, blah, blah. Like, which father would you choose? You know what I'm saying? And so I very much wanted to be his kid back then. But, you know, I wasn't. Or I was. You got to read the book because then I was, but then I wasn't. Oh,
gosh.
Oh, Guadalupe, my mother, man. Let's just say, look, she had three men thinking I was theirs.
That's more puppies than one girl needs.
Let me tell you, she was something else. We had a very difficult relationship. We butted heads like nobody business. My mother was an abusive person. But I cannot not look back and be like, Lupe. Like, wow. Like, you cannot
respect.
Look back and not be impressed.
Yeah.
Like, kind of weirdly impressed. Talk about survival instincts. She was a survivor.
And now you are too, because you have, you know, grown up and gotten out of those spaces that were difficult. And now you have your book, you have your career, you have you're respected in your field. It's what she dreamed for, you know?
Yes and no. Let me put it this way. It's so funny. When people read my book, everybody comes at it like, it's almost like a Rorschach test, you know, the psychological ink blots. It's like, what you tell me about your reaction to the book, not to freak anyone out, but I can see a bit of you, right? So for example, some of the older readers, older women, read and go, oh, but like Lupe would have been so proud of you. And she did such good with you. And I'm just like, did you read the same book that I wrote? Like, yeah, sure. But at what cost? I paid way too high a price, man. I should not have had to pay that price. I did not feel loved. I felt like a piece of property that had to perform, that had to do what I was told or else, that was put down constantly, that was constantly striving for love and affection. Children should not have to work so hard to be loved. And I think the biggest gift you can give your kids is that if you love them as they are and you invest in them, right? And you invest in yourself and your mental health so that you treat them with kindness, that kid will be a success because they'll be a success in the world. How do you define success? Sure. I mean, I did good, right? I did great. I'm in a good place financially and all that sort of stuff, but I could have traded some things for just more bit of being accepted for who I and loved for who I was.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. And then also looking back on it, now you've had all of this time to reflect on it. So you're no longer in those feelings. You've now put words to that situation. What does that feel like? I think like a lot of the time, like you said, it depends on what stage of the journey you're on. It depends if you're an older person who is going to see it as, oh, you're proud of your kid. Or if you're somebody who is, you know, in the moment of I'm struggling with my family and kind of going away from it. What does it feel like now to be able to, you know, be in your power and then put those words to the page and be open about it?
I definitely set out what I did what I set out to do. And I've heard back from so many wonderful people who have said, you've helped me think about my relationship with my mom differently. You've helped me see things differently with my mother. You've helped me see that I'm not alone in my relationship with my mother. Those things are huge. And it's funny, when my publisher first bought my book, she's also a mom, also a woman of color. And she was like, this book is going to help so many grown daughters with their mothers. And I was like, I hope so. You think? I hope so. And I'm like, yes, that's what I'm hearing. That makes me so happy. It fills my heart because it's easier for me now that she's been gone for 20 years, almost 20 years, right? I remember what it was like to live in it. It's painful. So I'm happy that it's out there. I'm also hoping like that I'm helping people understand that you don't have to forgive, but what you can do is you can understand, and that'll bring you peace too. So I don't necessarily forgive my mother or my father's because they haven't apologized. And I've given my father's opportunities to do so, and they've not. And they haven't changed behavior. And when I confronted my mother before she died, she told me a whole nother lie. Now, I know why she did it. It was survival on her part. And I go into that in the book, and you can see why I did, why she did it and why, you know, I accepted it. But to see her as that human being who made those decisions, not as my mother, but as a scared, desperate human being. That has helped my peace, like so much, I can't even tell you. I am at peace with her. I can now talk to her like a human being as opposed to be screaming in my head. You know what I mean? Like, even if your mother's still around, you're like, ay, caramba, Dios mio, da, da, da. You know, you're like, but now I can even just be very just calm talking with her spirit, you know?
Yeah, you've come to that place of healing. That's beautiful. We're going to come to the end of this section of the interview. We always do like a speed round of questions, fun things like cultural things. But before we get to that, I do want to hear maybe if you can share an anecdote, because on Mija podcast, basically the structure of the show is a fictionalized novella, which is largely based on my own family's immigration experience. So I hear you. I fictionalized it so that I could almost tell the stories we tell ourselves without feeling like I couldn't, you know, I didn't need to fact check everything that I was telling. I wanted to really tell the story in the best way, let's say. And so what we do is basically kind of do these kind of vignettes with those anecdotes, like a audio photo album moment. I don't know if you had like anything that immediately came to mind when I ask, okay, what is an anecdote that kind of defines your experience in some way as a child?
I describe this in the book. So Poppy used to come pick us up, my brother and I, on the weekends from our apartment up in Harlem. And he drove this big, crazy car, a gangster car. And he'd pick us up to take us out to fancy dinners on the weekends in Chinatown, mostly to show us off to his bosses or his colleagues. And my brother and I would get all dressed up. And Abuela would make me the cutest little outfits from like remnants from the salon. And she made me this little fur chubby coat out of remnants. And I had little go-go boots. And my older brother was all dressed up in his little suit. And he'd pick us up. And we'd, you know, be weaving through these huge restaurants, huge, with like white tablecloths and a dais in the back and red and gold everywhere. And he was such a charmer. He'd be going through saying hi to everyone, hey, and speaking in Mandarin. And we'd just be weaving through these two little like brown kids who did not look Chinese at all. And just in wonder, dressed up in our Dominicanness, living in this and then coming into this Chinese world. And he would bring us up to the dais where the boss was and show us off. And he used to tease me when we'd be at dinner. My favorite dish was like this whole steamed sea bass. And I could use chopsticks from, you know, day one. My favorite foods were mango and this steamed ginger bass. And he would tease me about, like, he'd take the eyeball and he'd bring it over to me and be like, eat the eyeball so you could see underwater. You know, it was disgusting. I'd be like, no. But it was beautiful to know where we would go to sleep at night, which is uptown with our Dominican family, but be sitting there with our Chinese father, with everyone chattering in Chinese around us and eating this incredible food. It's beautiful worlds.
Oh, thank you for sharing that. That is beautiful. All right. Now we are coming to an end. So I'm going to do the Miha speed round questions. You just have to answer like first thing that comes to your mind. Okay. So what language do you swear in when you accidentally touch a hot plate?
Oy, Spanish.
What's your favorite food?
Oh my gosh. All sorts of things. Dominican, mango, Chinese, whole ginger sea bass, American or Mexican food. Love Mexican food. Love. All of it. I put tahini on everything.
Oh, love that. All right. Song that you've had in your head this week.
Oh my gosh. I just saw Janet Jackson last night. So I've been listening to is Janet Jackson all week. So that's what's been in my head. And my daughter was in Into the Woods for her high school performance. So before that, it was a full week of Into the Woods.
Amazing. All right. What is your last Google search that you are comfortable sharing?
I don't even know what my last Google search was. Like, this is like not my research week. You caught me on a non-research week. But usually I'm Googling some crazy things like, I don't know, like for my next book, which covering some people in the civil rights and feminist rights movement. So it's like all that stuff from the 70s.
All right. What is the most embarrassing dream that you had for yourself when you were growing up?
Oh my gosh. I wanted to be an actor and a dancer. I wanted to be a solid gold dancer. Everybody who's a certain age knows what solid, go Google solid gold dancers and you will see that's what I was raised on. And these dancers were incredible. And ooh, I was in love. I thought I was going to be a solid gold dancer.
And what was your biggest dream that maybe you could say that you accomplished?
Oh, this book. And I am not just being a salesperson. This telling my story, feeling like I have a story to tell and it's important enough to tell and that it can touch people and that it's an American story. Oof, it's huge because hosting and co-creating and co-writing my own daily national TV show, I thought that was a big deal. This feels so much more because it's just me. I'm so happy to be in libraries. Those libraries that I lived in as a kid, oh, makes me so happy.
Oh, all right. That's it. Thank you so much for your time, Carmen. Now tell us where we can find you, where we can find your book. Is the audiobook out? There's an audiobook, right?
Yes. Yes, it's everything. You can get digital, you can audio. However, the hardcover is the only one that has the great pictures in it. But my paperback comes out this summer soon, so it's accessible to everyone. And I read the audio. I'm at KarmaRitaWong.com. And you can get the Spanish language version, Español también. And Instagram at Carmen Rita Wong.
Amazing. Oh, last thing. What is your advice to other Mijas who kind of want to learn more about their origins, make peace with their origins?
Do seek out help. Do seek out great therapy. I started out when I had no money on a sliding scale. Use resources, read, do a lot of self-exploration and do that self-work to get to know who you really are and what's very, very important to you. What's causing you pain and those patterns and what you can do. Self-awareness is key. Just be kind. Why does someone get you upset? Why? Just constantly be asking the why. That's the work that I mentioned. And it's just been tremendous and a tremendous help. And you can do that also with your relationship with your mother, for sure.
And or father.
And or fathers, no matter how many you have.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Carmen. This has been so much fun.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. This is Mija on the Mic, a season of reflection on our shared experiences as daughters of immigrants. Over the next couple of weeks, I'll be sharing stories like these and inviting guests to share theirs. Follow us on Instagram at Mija Podcast, that's M-I-J-A Podcast, and leave us a note if you like this story. Tune in every Wednesday for a new episode. This is a production of Studio Ochenta, a Latina-owned multilingual podcast studio dedicated to raising voices across cultures. For more from Studio Ochenta, follow us at Ochenta Podcasts on Instagram. That's O-C-H-E-N-T-A Podcast with an S on Instagram. P.S. Don't forget this season is also about you. If you have a story you'd like to share, or if you'd like to be a guest on the show, I invite you to reach out on Instagram at Mija Podcast and leave us a message with a short story or memory of yours that warms your heart. We'll read it out loud on the show. Hasta pronto. Ciao.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Did you know that Mija has her own audiobook with exclusive and brand new material? It's called Mija Podcast, the audiobook, an exclusive and never-before-heard collection of memoirs and reflections by her creator, Lori Martinez, about what it meant to turn her own migration story into a fiction series. When you get Ochenta's audiobooks, you're directly supporting our independent audio series productions. You can find it on Libro.fm, Apple Books, Google Play, Storytel, BookBeat, and on your favorite audiobooks app, also available in Spanish and French.